sacred dream about us. You and I have waited.
That's the voice of Karen Mason. I am the voice of Rick Cogan. The show is After Hours. Over the last few weeks, since the great Elif Garris abandoned myself and engineer Aubrey Mumpower to take a full-time real job as the producer of John Williams and his terrific new show, they have been revolving in a series of very bright and very nice young people to help produce this show. This week, Stephanie Menendez, the assistant program director, or whatever her title is, who started her career as the producer of this show, this show, how long this show's been on, decided to select Lise Graham. So I thought it was only right to introduce, you may have heard her name here and then over the last few weeks. Lise, you're the new producer of this show. I know it's an incredible burden for you, isn't it?
Yeah, you know.
So you must have thought, well, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know. Congratulations. You've been great to work with so far. And now we're going to work together. You, me, and Aubrey. It's a team. And Roger, of course.
The dream team.
All right. Who are you? How old are you? Where are you from? Why do you want to do something crazy like this?
Okay. So I'm Lise Graham, as you said. I'm from LaGrange. But I was born in Brookfield in my old family house, actually. What was the next question?
How old are you?
23.
23.
Mm-hmm.
I have no memory
and a half,
of 23. I have no. You have to say a half then. Yeah, you do. And where'd you go to school?
I went to U of I, Champaign.
To study what?
Broadcast. And I specialized in English and music, too. So I kind of got to mix it up.
Sure.
But yeah, it was, you know, it was a
with
fun
the
time.
Notion of I you know, they didn't teach, I'm sure, at the U of I. Well, you maybe why don't you try to get a job as a producer from a 9 to 11 p.m. show on Sunday. What is your ambition?
Hmm.
I mean, is it to host? Is it to run a station? Is it to, what is it? What did you go to school with the intention of?
Well, it changed, definitely. I mean, I came out of Lyons Township High School, and I was on WLTL. Their radio station there for all 4 years of high school.
What'd you do? Do you have a show?
I had a show.
What was it?
On management. I had a couple different shows, but mostly I played oldies. I'm a big oldie music fan. So
what is that? Wait, hold on. What does oldies mean to a 23-year-old? What is an oldie?
Beatles.
Oh, really? Oldie? Say the same as my oldies.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, lots of Beatles, lots of Bob Dylan. I'm a huge Joni Mitchell fan. Lots of Bowie and Prince.
Yeah.
So that was my main focus at WLTL. And then I went to U of I, and I was on WPGU, their alternative music station, which is student-run, but it's commercial. So that's a really cool experience because it's independent of the university.
Sure.
And I was a DJ. I was actually on the morning show there in my freshman year. That shifted things. It was like, okay, I liked being a DJ, but I don't know. And then I studied abroad, and then that just blew up my world. Sheffield, England, kind of by Manchester.
No, I know where it is.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And that just kind of changed everything, because I was like.
And so you come back here, and this being a big deal station, how did you get a job here in the first place?
Well, actually, the summer after my sophomore year of college, I got an internship at WGN Radio. I was one of the last sets
That's
of interns.
That's hard to get. You know that.
Yeah. It was awesome. I actually got an offer here from Alex Quigley, who was the
APD. Sure, I remember
APD.
Alex. Sure.
The same day I got an offer at XRT to be their morning show intern with Mary.
Wow.
And Lynn? Yep. And Mary.
Wow. Sure.
So it was a really hard decision, but ultimately neither one was paying me. So I was like, I'm going to go with the one that'll give me like normal hours. I can take
the
train
instead of.
That's
the story of modern internships,
exactly.
Isn't it?
But that was like the best, you know, one of the best summers. I was Kristen Decker's intern.
Nice.
Yeah. So we're very good friends to this day.
You know, one thing you can say about this place, there's some losers around here, but generally this is a nice crowd of people, don't you think?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm so lucky to work with, you know, so many close friends. It's pretty amazing. Everybody kind of just
accepts you. You're going to do this show full time now. but mm-hmm. it's only 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
Are you doing any other shows here?
I am. I produce On the Road with Dane Neal. So that's a newer show. It started up about 6-8 weeks ago. That's on Saturday afternoons. It's a car show, but we talk a lot of travel, which is what appeals to me, road trips, et cetera. And then right before that is the Startup Showcase with Scott Catoon, which is Technori. It's all about, you know, Chicago startups. And that's been really cool, too.
That does sound
I'm
cool.
the weekend girl now.
Okay, but that's
and
three.
Then during the week.
That's three shows. What's your real job?
I teach spin classes. Have you ever been to a spin class?
No. No, I know what they are. I know what they are.
So yeah.
Not only have I never been to one, I will never go to one, but I do know what they are.
I play a lot of oldies.
You play oldies?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Where do you teach this?
I teach those in LaGrange at the Daily Method, which is, they're actually like a ballet bar studio.
Is that where you live now? You still live in LaGrange?
Yeah, I'm still with my parents.
That's okay.
Oh, it's
that's
great.
Okay.
They're my not mom and dad, I'm sure they're listening.
They're not charging you rent, are they?
No, they aren't. Some of my friends' parents
are they
threatened to do that? But.
Are they proud of you? Did they say when you were in college, "Well, I want to major in broadcasting, and I think I want to be a DJ"? Did they say, "Well, why don't you think of something more practical"?
Never. They never said
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
They've been nothing but supportive. And
do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a big brother named
Doug. What
does he do? He is a newspaper reporter at the Daily Herald.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you both have gotten into these precarious businesses,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I don't know how that really happened. But
what do your folks do?
My dad is a musician by night. By day, he works for a medical delivery company, like medical supplies.
What kind of, not to give too much away about your family, but what kind of musician by night?
Oh, he hosts an open mic around the suburbs, the west suburbs. But he's in several bands, including one called the Salt Creek Boys. They're like bluegrass and
what does he
rock
play?
And roll. He plays guitar and he sings.
So if he does that, no wonder he said it's fine for one kid to
exactly.
be a journalist and the other to get
no
into
kidding.
The crazy business of radio.
And my mom's a nurse midwife. At,
oh, wow.
Illinois Masonic. She's been there for going on 35 years, I think. So
I know you've done this, I don't know, twice or three times, but you see kind of the format of the show, and you can easily slip in here as a reporter if you want to bring some guests in to do that. Aubrey, we've done that over the years with virtually everybody who's ever been a producer here. I think that's a kind of nurturing thing, and you get a sense of the kind of show this is, which is kind of free form
totally.
And free flowing. I would love it. Are you game?
Oh,
to,
I'm so game. Yeah.
Certainly, I know
on
you
the,
don't get
on the record. I am game.
Yeah, this is right. You can't lie. Your parents are listening.
Exactly.
You can't be lying to me on the radio. So I'd love it if you'd love to do cover some music. Maybe you could even cover your dad, one of your dad's many bands.
Oh,
that would actually be really
fun. They would love that.
That would actually
we'll
be really
happen.
Fun. I hope you're listening. hope you don't mind driving in. How do you get back and forth from here?
My parents' reliable 2004 Chevy Impala.
That's great.
Yeah, gotta love those parking spaces back there. And
what do you think you want? What do you think you want to cover? I don't want to put you on the spot and have your dad's band be the first report you make for the show.
Ooh, for the show.
Yeah. You want to do a music thing?
Yeah. I'm really into like music stuff. I'm actually starting my own podcast. I literally recorded the first episode of it today.
Well, of course you are.
Of course I am.
And you're interviewing Roger Badish, who may be the world's greatest radio guest.
Exactly.
What's your podcast?
So that is, it's called Lease FM, and it's going to, really my favorite question to ask any kind of emerging artist, and that's what I'm going to focus on is like new, fresh-faced amateurs.
Music or everything?
Film, yeah, kind of everything, is who are your influences? And I used to ask it as kind of like a, you know, just a nice icebreaker.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Oh, I love the Beatles too, you know. But then I kind of realized like that's where it all really is. If
no
you want
to
align, you know, a listening audience with a new band, what better way than to, you know, say that, hey, they're also into X, Y,
when it also, when you take that question a little deeper, it also it will prompt a smart musician or writer or anybody else to really think about it. I mean, some people just give the quick answer. Yeah, like Dylan was a great influence. Then you have to ask why.
Right.
Why? What
exactly.
about Dylan was a great influence for
so
you?
So my goal here is, and I'm starting with a lot of friends' bands.
Sure.
I want it to be more of a dialogue, and I'm going to have them like do their prep work. They're going to, you know, come up with five, you know, key songs or, you know, parts of novels or scenes from movies that really have inspired them. So then we can like move through them and they will have been thinking
about
it.
Where can the listeners find your podcast?
I don't know yet. I literally recorded the first episode today, hopefully on WGN Plus sometime.
That'd be great.
That's on
all right,
the record
I'll put in a pitch for you.
Okay.
Lisa, I think it's going to be great fun. I hope it's rewarding for you. And if nothing else, you get to meet some. Roger's met some nice people. Roger's met like half the guys he went to high school with on this show. So I hope you get to meet some nice people. I think we'll have fun. And I do want you to be a part of the show. And I think the listeners just listening to you for 10 minutes, I think the same thing.
Awesome.
It's going to be a great collaboration. And Aubrey is like our big brother or my younger brother or whoever. We're like a family here. Roger is the young brother who we keep in the attic or wherever you are back there. Well, welcome to the full-time job here. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, let's take a little break, and then we're going to listen to some statues talk.
We move too fast. We miss so much. We seldom see.
That's Karen Mason, who you can hear and see at Davenport May 17th to the 20th. She's gone from Chicago clubs to Broadway stardom in such shows as Mamma Mia, Hairspray, Sunset Boulevard, Wonderland. She's celebrating her new CD at Davenport's. It's titled It's About Time, and it is her first in 9 years, which is a real reason for celebration. She's going to be performing with special guest Paul Ronick, who also has a new CD out, which you will hear next week. Spread around this city for almost the last 2 years have been, there are a lot of statues in this city. You see them, turn a corner and you'll see a statue. 30 of them have been talking. You go to a little sign near the statue and you do something or other with your phone, and you can hear these statues talk. It's a marvelous, wonderful program called Statue Stories Chicago, which is also the website, statuestorieschicago.com. Here is a sample. They've extended the run of these statues through the summer. They will be here, not the run of the statues. The statues will always be here, but the voices and stories with the statues. Here are, in order, three of them. The first one is of the Miro, which is in the heart of the Loop. This is written and voiced by Shonda Rhimes, who may be the most successful television person to ever come out of the Chicago area. She's behind Scandal and a number of other shows. Here, ladies, they're only each 2 minutes long. Here's Miro.
They didn't like me when I first arrived. They judged me, as people tend to do. They called me a caricature, referred to me as a mistake, whispered that I was uninventive. I'm not sure what it was about me exactly that bothered them so much. Perhaps it was my size. I am quite large, towering above you in a hulking way. Perhaps it was the way I've styled myself. That fork sticking out of the top of my head is not quite the prim and proper adornment you'd expect from a statue like me. Maybe it was the round fullness that defines my base, like big hips, wide and cumbersome, not at all elegant. I don't know. Whatever it was, they didn't like me. But I am a Chicagoan, born and raised. This is my city. If I can take the winter and the wind, I can take a taunt or a snub. I've planted myself on this spot, and I do not intend to move. After all, I didn't move even when a protester threw paint on me. Judge me. Dislike me. Mock me. I'll wait. I'll stand here steady as time itself. You'll walk by me, you'll pace around me, you'll eat lunch next to me, and then one day, you'll look up and you'll realize what I've always known. It's the same thing all women should know about themselves. Other people's judgments are wrong. My fork does not stick out of my head. It grows from my crown like a shooting star. My hips are neither wide nor cumbersome. They are powerful and mighty, strong enough to keep me standing where others would fall. I cannot be knocked down. My size is not too large. I am this tall on purpose because I'm reaching for the sky. I am different. I am an original. And like everyone else, I am here to take up space in the universe. I do so with pride. I am the sun, the moon, and one star. But now that we are acquainted, you can call me Miss Chicago.
Isn't that nice? That's Shonda Rhimes being the voice, and she wrote the script for two of the Moreau creation in the loop. The next one you'll hear, there are 30 of these. They're going to be talking through August. It's funded by the Richard Driehaus Foundation, produced by some people in England. But they're fabulous. If you haven't taken advantage of this, just go to Statues Stories Chicago. Statue Stories Chicago. Here, written by Paul Jurwitz and voiced by Jack McBrayer, is Shakespeare. He's in the park.
Well met, dear stranger. Guess who? That's right. It's me, Christopher Marlowe. Nah, I'm just yanking your proverbial chain. Tis none other than Bill Shakespeare, the immortal bard himself, immortalized before you. But what's in a name? A statue by any other name is still just a fancy hunk of metal hanging out in the park. And I've been sitting here in Lincoln Park since 1894. But all that glitters is not necessarily gold. I'm bronze, and I was cast in Paris. Yeah, I had to wait nearly 300 years after my death before I was cast in anything again. You see, in my lifetime, I wasn't merely the humble, devastatingly handsome playwright you see before you. I tread the boards myself. I am said to have played King Duncan in Macbeth, King Henry in Henry IV, and the ghost of Hamlet's father in... Oh, I can't remember the name of that one. Anywho, now I just play the ghost of myself. I was designed for the Columbian Exposition in Chicago by a local sculptor named William Partridge. Born of a partridge and befriended by squirrels. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown of pigeon? But I think it complements my authentic Elizabethan duds quite nicely. I figure you gotta dress to the nines if you want to call this neighborhood home. And from up here, I get to watch all you mortals playing your parts. The well-to-dos walking their tiny little dogs. The lovers strolling hand in hand. The kiddos flying their kites. And the animals escaping the Lincoln Park Zoo. So look around you, my friend. Take it all in. 'Cause a wise man once said, this is very Midsummer Madness. I can't remember who. No bother. Ah, parting is such sweet sorrow. But I can confidently declare I will be here tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Fun, huh? That's Shakespeare in Lincoln Park. Again, you can go to statuestoryschicago.com to find out where all 30 of these are and how to access them. We're going to be a little late to the news because I do want you to hear this last one. It's only 2 minutes and 3 seconds. It is written by the great Chicago, young, but great Chicago playwright Ike Holter and voiced by movie star Elizabeth McGovern. Here you go.
Greetings. Look upon me. Everybody deserves a drop to drink. From the king to the unseen and everybody in between. We all need a little something to keep going. And that's where I come in. They call me Hebe, goddess of youth. Always around to pick you up when you're down. Daughter of Zeus. Here to the end, a forever friend. I was put into existence to serve the cup of everlasting life. Now some people say that I went off and married Hercules. Some people say that I had wings. Some people say that I always walked around without my clothes on. Some people say a lot of things, okay? But what I know is this. I know that showing compassion and trust and mercy was my one true mission. My reason for being, my genius. And now, I pass that task on to you. This statue in my visage was commissioned by Joseph Rosenberg, a paperboy who could never even get a drop of water from anybody passing by while he worked in the Chicago heat. After making a fortune, Rosenberg left money for this fountain to stand as a reminder to the community. Sometimes, we all need that one helping hand. And, if you are lucky enough to rise from what binds you, never ever forget the taste of thirst. Give back, so others may do the same. Look upon me now. Everybody deserves a drop to drink.
Isn't that lovely? StatueStoriesChicago.com. I'll keep reminding you, it's up through August. Through August, there are 30 statues that will talk to you in that kind of poetic, dramatic way.
Dear, when you smiled at me, I heard
a Karen Mason performing May 17th to the 20th at Davenport's. I'll tell you more about it because I want to concentrate now on Rana Weinberg. Rana, welcome to the show. Thank you for getting me the book on Bittersweet Place. I get a lot of books, as you can imagine, and so my normal course of action is to open them and start reading the first couple of pages, and I was beyond hooked by the story of a young woman coming of age in Chicago in the early part of the 20th century. You had a very, very highly praised collection of short stories published in 2006. This is your first novel. Tell me, how arduous is that chore of writing a first novel?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
I'm my pleasure
to be here, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed the book. Writing a novel is a very I don't know if it's an arduous process, but it's really a long-term project. It takes a long time to write a novel. So when I began this novel, I actually envisioned it as a collection of linked short stories about a Russian girl and her family. But when I started to write a couple of stories, I realized I had enough material for a novel.
There's a grand tradition of the, you know, sort of Jewish immigrant story, and most of them, with the exception of a certain Mr. Saul Bellow of Chicago fame, most of them are generally set in New York. What made you choose, and I think it's a brilliant choice, Chicago? You did not grow up here. I know you have relatives here, but you did not grow up here. What made you choose Chicago?
Thank you. Actually, I did. Well, I grew up in Lincolnwood, so outside of
Close
Chicago.
Enough.
But I chose Chicago because I thought it would be a different place than New York and maybe a less harsh place for an immigrant family. And I wanted to do something a little bit different than what other people had done.
And Bittersweet being a real street here, you have some, do you not, familiarity with that street, yes?
Yes, my aunt and uncle lived on the street when I was a young child, and I had visited it, and the name always had a certain resonance for me. So I just thought it would be a good place to put Lena and her family. I like the area and the name.
Do you mind if I read a little something from your book?
No, I'd love for you to read it. Thank you.
Well, this is set October 1925. Bittersweet Place was just one block long and narrow like a snake, a street that went nowhere, I thought. It stopped at Clarendon to the west, and at what my father called, quote, the street with no name, end quote, to the east. Our street had such an odd name, not a beautiful one like others in the neighborhood, Belle Plain or Cornelia. I wondered how something could be both bitter and sweet and why we had to end up here at all. That, Rona, is lovely, lovely writing. How you spent some time at various Thank foundations, you. Including Ragdale. I don't want you to have to give away your secrets, but this book seems like one you can't possibly run a dash off a paragraph like that, can you? That is a paragraph that one would necessarily work pretty hard to craft, yes? Or are you just a literary genius?
No, I think it took some time to craft. I mean, I think what happens is, as a writer, I have an idea and I write a few sentences, and then I really have to chisel it and work at it to make it have some sort of rhythm. And in fact, with that particular section, it was interesting because the street with no name is actually Marine Drive
now.
Yeah,
sure.
And when I was writing the book, I realized that I didn't know whether or not the street was called Marine Drive in the 1920s. So I called someone at the Chicago Public Library, and they actually looked at some old maps for me, and they said that the street didn't have a name at that time.
That's fabulous.
So that's
One of the other things that I got from your book, and I know you did grow up in Lincolnwood, it does not give you a familiarity with Chicago of the 1920s and teens. How much research did you have to do? Or did you feel, you know, the imagination is one thing, but this book is really finely grounded in Chicago of that time. Did you do deep research, or did you allow imagination to take over?
Well, it was a combination. I imagined a lot, but I had to do research about some of the details of the city, like the Wrigley Building, when that was built, what the lake was like at that time, what daily life was like. So I had to do research. Also, I wanted to find out where streetcars and buses ran, just so that things would be very grounded and very factual.
Well, I'm going to read, if I might, I want to read something else that I think really captures. There are a lot of paragraphs I could read. I could, you know, sort of put you on hold, frankly, Rana, and just read from the book. But this is one of the paragraphs that grabbed me. And as I said, when I get a book, I will, with a very nice note from you, I will start the book, and if I'm not grabbed in a little while, there's nothing I can do about it. You know what I mean? I'll put it down. But the second paragraph of your book is this. From the open window, I imagined I could see all the way to Maxwell Street, where pushcarts squeezed one next to another like squatters' houses, where the odors of sweet warm breads and foul raw chicken rose in the air. If I walked east from the apartment, I knew I would find the blue waters of Lake Michigan. That, too, Rana, is a beautifully wrought paragraph. Are you, as a writer, when I say that, how do you feel about that? And I'm not talking about the praise of it. Is there any sense of reward for the work that you put into a paragraph like that? Because that, too, cannot be one that just, you know, fell out of your computer.
Well, first of all, thank you for reading it and for saying that. And it's gratifying that the paragraph works for you, because I did work hard on the sentences in the paragraph. And, sometimes it's really hard to get something to work. So yeah. I'm really pleased that you as a reader enjoyed it and that it really spoke to you.
Well, we will talk. And then on the following page, and this book begins with, I think, what is a terrific bang. It doesn't begin with a murder. It's not a murder mystery. It is very much a coming of age, and many of the things that Lena goes through are not at all pleasant. We will get into the adventures of Lena. I don't mean to compare it with Augie March, because she's quite a different kind of character with Rana Weinberg. When we return momentarily, you can go to Rana's website, which is a very nice website, RonnaWeinberg.com.
It's actually Wine.
Oh, Wine. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I missed.
Right. Yeah, that's okay.
Wine. You people are smart. You'll get it. We will be back with Rana momentarily. Rana Weinberg has written a marvelous, moving, and exciting novel titled On Bittersweet Place, set in Chicago in the mostly in the 1920s. It is the story of a young girl named Lena Zernitsky and her trials and tribulations, Rana. But the thing about this young woman is her voice is unbelievably distinctive, I think, and so endearing. Is that a good read of this young woman?
Thank you. Yes, that's what I hoped for, and I really worked hard to try and capture her voice.
Yeah,
so I'm happy that it worked.
Well, it does work. She goes through some tough times, does she not? I don't want you to give away much, but there are trials and tribulations here that, in one specific instance, and you know what I'm talking about, could be it could be almost crippling. But you also, she has such a wonderful outlook. Again, early on in the book, in the prologue, she writes down a list of her fears. I will never speak good English. Will not have one American friend. Will not be attacked on the street by an American patrulla. I will lose someone dear to me. I will never have a home that is safe. I will never grow up. I will never, ever know happiness again. That's unbelievably moving. She does indeed find, I'm not trying to make this some kind of modern day horror story. She does indeed find happiness, but her life reflects the struggles that I think it's kind of a universal in the way that anybody new to a place will withstand the slings and arrows of that place, don't you think?
Yes, yes, I think so. And I think as an immigrant during that time, many people probably went through not the same but similar struggles.
I'm sure you're hearing from, especially from readers in Chicago, that, this little girl reminds me of my grandmother. This little girl reminds me of my mom. Have you been hearing that?
Yes, I have. Some people have said that, you know, they've heard family stories that are similar to that.
Where did you find...
Which is interesting.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Where did you find her voice?
I just, you know, I really experimented with it. I wrote... I wrote the, when I was writing at first, the first couple of chapters, I had the plot, but I didn't have the voice.
Yeah.
And so I just kept on doing it again and again. And actually, when I came to the chapter on Leah Grace, I finally kind of captured her voice. And then I was able to go back and change her voice at the beginning. And as I moved through the novel, her voice became more distinct. So one of my revision projects was to really was really to go back and work on the voice so that it was consistent.
Well, I think that is work. That is a time for you well spent. You do mention, you just mentioned the rape. She is raped by a relative. And that is I found it a very chilling moment in this saga. Was that hard to write?
It was hard to write. It was very hard to write. It was upsetting to have that happen to her. And I also had to decide how, you know, how vividly and graphically I wanted to make it. So I wanted it to be, you know, something that was really invasive and difficult, but maybe not the worst thing possible. So I rewrote that many times. I worked on that.
She does. I'm kind of was taken, too, with her. She gets a boyfriend, and that's I find him a fascinating character. And that relationship, again, a relationship of serious ups and downs. That too is a highlight, I think, of this novel.
Uh huh. I'm glad. I really liked the character of the boyfriend, and I
Max,
liked
how
their relationship developed. Max, yeah. It was fun to write about, and it was wonderful to see how their relationship developed. When I began the novel, I didn't know that they would have a relationship.
Sure.
I didn't even know that he would be an important character. So
that is one of the joys of literature, though, when you dive in. It's kind of like in many ways, it's kind of like swimming in a river. You're in the river, but you don't know quite what the next bend might show you. Is that a idiotically metaphorical way to put it, or no?
Yeah, no, that's a very good way to put it. You're swimming along, and you don't know what you'll see or discover or what will occur to you.
When you
When
you finished the book, was there a sense of, maybe not when you finish, because I've talked to enough novelists, it's kind of when you saw the book, when the book arrived at your house, and it's a beautiful cover, I love these sort of vintage, the real vintage look of the cover. Did you feel empowered? How did you feel finishing your first novel?
It was really thrilling to hold the book in my hands.
Yeah.
Because it was such a long process. It was just like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad you liked the cover.
I love it.
I was, oh good. I was thrilled to see the cover too. So it was just a wonderful experience, you know, to know that I'd completed a novel, and not only completed it, but that it was published.
In this book publishing era, that is a triumph, Rana. That is a triumph. You spent some time at Ragdale, which is one of the most beautiful writers' colonies in the world, which happens to be here in Lake Forest. Did you work on this book while you were there?
I did. I worked on parts of the book when I was there.
That kind of thing, that foundation support for a writer is I think you thank them in the acknowledgments.
Yes.
An essential element. Don't you think you've got to get away to focus a bit?
It really helps. It's just wonderful to go away and focus on the writing, because when you're not distracted, so many things occur to you. For example, when I was at Ragdale, I visited Lake Michigan a lot, and that helped me with some of the sections on the lake and describing it and just the feeling of being there.
What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on some more stories, and I'm working on another novel.
Set in Chicago, I ask?
No, this novel is set in Denver.
Denver? What?
Yes.
You live in New York, right?
Yes, I do. But I did at one time live in Denver.
Oh, okay. So there is some connection. I ordered your short story collection, by the way, after finishing this, because this is a very, very, very accomplished novel. And coming-of-age novels are not my thing, but I cannot tell you how hooked I was on those first two pages and read through it in half a day, I think, or a long night. Well, and I've underlined a million different things in here. I do that with books. I think of them as mine and pristine, and these are my underlinings in here. To your credit, Rana Weinberg, On Bittersweet Place is a great Chicago novel. I'll leave it at that. How's that?
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm really thrilled that you like the book.
Very much.
It's
very,
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 very
much.
Satisfying.
And I really adore the character. You know, my father's family being
Thank
Russian
you.
Jews too, so there's that. You got that going for
that
you when
connection.
when it comes to me, Rana. The next time, how often do you get to Chicago?
I get to Chicago maybe once a year or so.
Okay.
I actually may be coming in the summer to visit some family.
Let me know, and then you can come in here and we can meet face to face and talk more about writing, which is arduous, ladies and gentlemen, but it can also be joyful, can it not?
That's true. It's both.
Pleasure to meet you, and even a greater pleasure, I must tell you, to read you. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, that's very sweet. It's called On Bittersweet Place, Rana Weinberg, RONNAWINE. BERG.com. It's a lovely website too. Congratulations! The first novel can be the beginning of great things, and I hope it is for you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay, you too.
It is a good book, ladies and gentlemen. A fine, fine book. We're going to be talking about another book in a few minutes. It's My great friend Laura Caldwell helped put this book together, and it is at once chilling, hopeful, frightening, a lot of things. It's called Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies from the Wrongfully Convicted. So please, please stay tuned.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but
it's the one and only Karen Mason, who's performing at Davenport from May 17th to the 20th. My old and very dear friend Laura Caldwell is in here with my new best friend Antoine Day, who is promoting a show. We'll talk about that later. Laura's a novelist of great talent, but she is also a lawyer and works on the innocent. She gets innocent people out of jail, and there are a lot of innocent people in jail. And her newest book is called Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies from the Wrongly Convicted. She edited this book with Leslie Klinger. Who is this Leslie Klinger fellow?
He is another attorney, writer, who is in L.A., winner of an Edgar Award. And he annotates and does a lot of anthologies as well. So he's kind of known for this type of thing.
This book, and I'm sure, Antoine, feel free to get in anytime here, this is one of the most ambitious projects I've ever encountered in my life, because it tells the stories of, I think, if I counted correctly, 15 people who were wrongly convicted of crimes they had nothing to do with and wound up spending time in prison. Antoine, you were among those people. And Laura, you and this Mr. Klinger, who I do not know, paired them with various writers of varying stature and abilities to help tell their stories. Is that basically?
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of merging, you know, my two worlds, which is I'm a novelist and a thriller writer, and then I run the After Innocence Clinic at Loyola, where we help people start over after they are shown to be innocent. And I sort of never thought those two things shall merge. But so many authors kept offering to help, and I couldn't envision a way that they could really help. I didn't, as you know, people's stories are so complex. As Antoine mentioned earlier, there's not just two sides, there's 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So instead of giving somebody one of these writers, like we have Lee Child, and we have the wonderful Sarah Paretsky, and
Jamie Frivoletti, and Michael Harvey, and was it at all hard to convince any of these people to get involved?
No, that was the easy part. We actually kept getting people, you know, reached out saying, oh, I'd love to be a part, and we'd say, sorry, if we do it again, you know, we'll it was not difficult, really, to get the exonerees. The pairing was interesting because some people we put with someone that's like their character. We put Lee Child with a very Jack Reacher character named Kirk Bloodsworth.
Nah.
And he is.
Well, I don't see any similarities at all between Jamie Frivoletti and Antoine Day. Was it, Antoine? I'm glad you came in, and thanks, Lord, for bringing him in.
Thanks for having me.
Was it? Because these stories are so otherworldly. It's like they're all almost fictional in their craziness. Was it tough for you to be debriefed? Did you want to tell Jamie your story, or what was that the relationship like?
I did and I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes when you get into telling these stories, man, it digs up so much pain. And for myself, it was painful in a lot of, you know, different segments of it.
Sure.
But I was more than happy to, because on the other side of that, you want people to understand what goes on. A lot of people think it only happens to somebody else.
Yeah.
It can knock on your door at any moment.
See, one of the interesting things about this book, too, that's going to destroy people's misconceptions is that these are men and women. These are white and black. I think there's this perceived notion, Antoine, you're black. There's this perceived notion with the only people who could ever possibly, it's impossible that only a poor black man could wind up innocent in jail. That's crazy, isn't it, Laura?
It is unfortunately very inaccurate. Yeah, I mean, what we were trying to do is show what it's like to be in the soul of someone who goes through these things. And so the first chapter we call The Knock on the Door. That's a 34-year-old brunette law student in California.
Yeah.
That's about the most unlikely sounding person to be wrongfully convicted. And we have Audrey Edmond, who's a dear friend. She's from Wisconsin. She's a beautiful blonde mom who was helping take care of the neighborhood kids. And one of them passed away, and she was accused, and she lost her family and went away for 10 years. So unfortunately, it can and does happen to anyone.
Well, injustice has no race, no color, no creed. It's just injustice. And it hits everybody.
But there's some. I mean, I'm going to read a couple things from the book. This is something Scott Turow leads off the book, and he writes that there's a paramount lesson in this book. It is that even good people, even dedicated professionals within the system, make mistakes with horrible consequences for defendants. Certainly the most heartrending parts of the book, and Antoine, I want to talk to you about this too because it's pretty heartrending for you. Parts of the books are the reports of virtually every wrongfully convicted person about the horrors of prison, the fear, the regimentation, the often brutal conditions, and the psychic pain of knowing that punishments are not only undeserved, but the result of a supposedly careful system for finding the truth. Antoine, how could you and many of these other people, and Laura, you can answer this too, how could you not lose hope?
Well, I had a great, great, strong mother who prayed, who kept me encouraged. But there has been times when I have lost hope.
Yeah.
There has been moments when I wish that the gunshot would ring and I would be on the other side of the bullet. I have felt that way because When they bury you in a hole and it's hard to breathe, it's like everything is closing in on you. You have those moments. But then when I look at my son and my daughters and my mom and my father and my brothers and sisters who continue to encourage me to be strong, then I have to stand up. You know, I didn't want to lose to the system that I know was wrong, so I had to fight back.
See, but I think, Laura, that's one of the overriding thing and the thing that haunts me so much in the book Anatomy of Innocence, is it gives me some hope that these people can remain hopeful, but it's so depressing that the circumstances that you find yourself, it's inconceivable to a person walking down the street that they, it's like some weird Hitchcock movie or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I really think it is. And in fact, I think, you know, for anyone who gets out of prison, it's a shock to the system. The system has moved on and changed, even if you've been in there a couple of years. Whew, things have changed. But I would argue that if you're innocent, it's even more jarring, even more shocking, because you have spent so much time getting your head around the fact. And, you know, most of these guys and women will gut check themselves. They're not crazy. So they'll go through a whole thing where they're like, maybe, I don't know, everybody seems to think I did.
Maybe I did.
So they go through that.
Well, I mean,
that's the whole
gist of false confessions, too. I mean, that's what you're locked away long enough. I want to read one more thing before we take a break. And Antoine, I'm so glad you're here because I want to get deeply into your case. Laura, you and your co-author, whatever this guy, Klinger, whatever his name is, I'm sure he's a very fine guy, just never heard of him. Leslie Klinger, you both write collaboratively, and I think this is a very important point for anybody who wants to buy this book, because I'm sure some of you are going, oh, man, you know, who cares about innocent people? They write, "This book is not intended as an indictment of the U.S. legal system, not of the thousands of law enforcement officials, prosecutors, defense attorneys, investigators, judges, or juries who make up the system, nor does this book claim that the great majority of convicted persons are innocent of crimes. Rather, the stories told here acknowledge that, as with all human endeavors, the operators of the machinery of justice have flaws and weaknesses." We'll take a quick break and be back with Antoine Day and the great Laura Caldwell.
What are you doing the rest of your life?
That's Karen Mason, and so I'm going to let that question go to one of my guests, Antoine Day. You were in jail for how long?
Too long.
Yeah, no kidding.
Over 10 years.
For a crime you had nothing to do with.
Exactly.
I mean nothing to do with. How did you find Antoine Laura Caldwell? He is one of the 15 people featured in Anatomy of Innocence, Testimony of the Wrongly Convicted, which is a fantastic, I use that word sparingly, but I use it here, fantastic book. How did you find Antoine? How do you know him?
I was working with an exoneree named Marvin Reeves, and I was taking him to an appointment for some job counseling. And as we're at this appointment at a community center up on the north side, someone walks by and Marvin jumps up and these two are hugging it out. And this was Mr. Antoine Day. So he turns out he's working as a reentry specialist. He has us come in the back. We're talking to him. And as he's talking, I'm asking him, he says, I had 10 years myself, but this and this. And I kept saying, you're saying you're innocent, but are you an exoneree? He had never heard the word. And he kept, what do you mean? And I kept asking more about his case. And finally I said, look, I don't know if you're telling the truth or if you're accurate about what your case looks like, but if what you say is accurate, you're an exoneree and you have about 27 days to file for a certificate of innocence to get state money.
See, you didn't even know that. One of the things in your chapter 13, The Last Bad Morning, that he learned, Antoine Day was imprisoned for a murder, an attempted murder that he did not witness and for which he was ultimately found completely innocent by the court that convicted him. When he was released, Antoine learned that while imprisonment was terrible, release from prison was not the end of his troubles. He learned firsthand how little, quote, justice, unquote, is afforded an exoneree upon release and how freedom is just the beginning. That, in a sense, that you're just sort of said, I mean, you must be anybody who is let out, just, oh, man, let me out of here. I'm good. I'm going to go see my mom, and she's going to take care of me for a couple of days. I can have a cheeseburger. I can have a girlfriend. stuff like that, but you don't know you're owed.
Right. You have no idea because, you know, and I think it's unfair to justice system is to make you responsible for anything knowing that they have wronged you.
Yes.
You think they would step up and say, well, look, we're going to make sure we take care of this, that, and other. They didn't even give me a bus pass. They put me on the street, 26 in California.
Yeah. And some buddy of yours came by.
Yeah, he did. And thank God because—
You had a sense of humor, though. I got to tell you something. The buddy comes by. Some guy drives by, and he says, what are you doing out here? Somebody, and Antoine, and what are you doing out here? And Antoine says, I busted out. And then Jamie Frivoletti writes, the man paused, then both laughed. Get in, and I'll drive you home. Your sense of happiness must have been sky high.
Man, I was overwhelmed. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Standing in the rain for over 3 hours, I didn't know what to do. I was soaking wet. I was smelling like a mule, you know. And I was really shocked. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know which way to go, where to turn. I didn't know anything. And if he hadn't have drove up, I would probably still be standing right today.
Well, Lord, beyond even that, I mean, that's like getting a ride home. But nobody, most people getting freed for crimes they didn't commit, they have no idea. They're just happy to be out, right?
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, the circumstances under which someone can be sort of exonerated vary from Antoine's experience with no fanfare, nobody around, to their, you know, those scenes that we sometimes see on TV where there's, you know, your lawyers holding up your hands.
Sure, right, right, right.
But whether you have Antoine's version or that version, the fact is that the TV cameras go off and go home.
No question.
And then life is yours to do with as you wish, apparently.
Well, but as you wish, too, and you don't, you know, obviously your record is expunged and you're not a convicted felon sometimes, right?
Right. That was something that at Loyola we focus on criminal records relief, getting things off of their record because it stays on there.
Yeah, right.
Unless you go pick it off. Yeah. And in fact, even when people had certificates of innocence, it was staying on there. So one of the pieces of legislation we passed was that it be you can ask for it automatically. So if your certificate of innocence is granted, you can ask the judge right there. And that's been.
But in short, there's a lot of things that won't allow it still that's written into the law, you know, that you have to be totally 100%. You know, no idea of what took place. You know, they have so many ways they can tie you to things because they don't want to take the responsibility.
Yeah.
We make everybody else in this world, around this world, stand up for the wrongs that they do to other people.
Sure.
But we right here in America, we are doing it constantly and every day.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many ladies that are coming home now that's been wrongfully incarcerated, shaken baby syndrome, bad science.
Sure.
A lot of things going on that we know the system is not broke. We just, some things we need to fix in it. Everything is not broken.
Well, it needs
to
be equitable. I mean, life needs to be equitable. But why do you not have, and I don't sense it from you, why isn't there this incredible bitterness? Why don't you have?
I want to live. Bitterness kills. I don't want to kill. I want to live. I want to bring life and joy into my space. So if I walked around angry and bitter, that's like 500 pounds of weight that you carry every day. I don't want to do that. If I was angry, I wouldn't have met, you know, my best friend here, Laura, you know, who's beautiful, a caring person. So that's the crowd I want to be. I don't want to be in a hateful crowd.
Yeah. What do you do now?
Well, I work at BBF, Family Services on the West Side. I'm a reentry specialist. I work with men and women coming home from prison. We help them get housing, jobs, employment, whatever it needs. It's a wraparound service for the whole community, the whole family. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to come back and be who they say I couldn't be in my community.
What did you want to do before?
My music. Music
is my
life.
You were dancing and music.
Yeah. So music, I still play music. We have the Exoneree Band that we travel.
Yeah, that's right.
Group of five exonerees. We travel the country. We play our music. We have some really good CDs. Y'all need to buy them. but we're just living life, man, and trying to bring an awareness to the streets. You know, if it wasn't for Laura, a lot of this wouldn't have took place because she also designed the band and kind of pushed it together,
sure,
you know,
sure,
from one phone call and made it happen. So
Laura Caldwell, why do you think, and that's a very, very hopeful philosophy you have, Antoine, why no bitterness? I mean, right, there must be some. I mean, some people must be sort of paralyzed by bitterness, yes?
But
generally, most of the people I've met through you are not bitter.
I think that I used to think that there was a lack of bitterness. What I've learned, and this is such a complicated, you know, thing made overly simple, but exonerees seem to me to be the most adept people at choosing emotions. And they see emotions and they realize, so the only thing I control right now is my airspace. I don't control when I eat, when I get up, what I wear, when I shower. This is the only, and it's not going to hurt the cop who should have known better. So they get very good at choosing their emotions. And so I think it's not that there isn't bitterness and anger, but that they are very good choosers.
Well, really, really well put. The book is Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted, edited by Laura Caldwell and her new friend, who I'd like to meet sometime, Leslie Klinger. It's got Scott Turow. It's got Barry Scheck. It's got Lee Child. It's got Jamie Frevoletti writing about my new friend Antoine here. Yeah. It's got Michael Harvey, Sarah Paretsky, a number of other great writers telling
and
these
Arthur
stories.
Arthur Miller.
We'll talk about Arthur Miller. I'm not letting you guys go.
Oh, okay, good.
Because Antoine's got to talk about Adele Givens and her show coming up. Yeah, we'll get to it. Please stay tuned. We'll be back right after the news. We're talking off the air. Laura Caldwell is in here. She is the co-editor with Leslie Klinger of a haunting, chilling, and hopeful book. That's what I'm saying, Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongly Convicted, which Laura and her pal, Mr. Klinger, paired a number of exonerated people, such as Antoine Day, who is sitting here in the studio, with various writers. Jamie Frevoletti, a very talented novelist, wrote about Antoine. Arthur Miller is in this book. What's Arthur Miller doing in this book?
Can I just say that I am Arthur Miller's editor?
Me? Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. How,
I edited
how
this,
hard did you have to work that piece?
I might have added a comma. Arthur Miller worked for and on behalf of a kid in Connecticut who was wrongfully accused and convicted of killing his mom. And what we're trying to show in the book is that anybody who's gone through a wrongful conviction, everybody's got that knock on the door. Everybody's got hearing the guilty verdict. Everybody's got walking into prison for the first time. Everybody's got trying to find someone to help you. Sometimes it's a lawyer, and sometimes it's the community. And there's a very well-known case called the West Memphis Three.
Oh, sure,
and
sure.
We were going to use that as to show. I mean, Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder and all these people came out, and it was sort of the power of that and these rallies that helped to get them out of prison.
Yeah, the power of celebrity, yeah.
But then I realized they had not been completely exonerated. They had taken an Alford plea. So we were almost going to forgo the community chapter when I was talking with Rob Warden from Center on Wrongful Convictions. Yep. Now the Chicago Justice Watch, I believe it's called, and mentioned that it's too bad, and maybe I could have got Johnny Depp to write the piece. And Rob's like, remember you and I have talked about this. We always tried to put together writers and exonerees somehow. And we go to his office, and sure enough, he pulls out a piece by Arthur Miller about how he and the community members had to basically beg and scream and to plead to get this kid out of jail. And yet what happened is, in order for him to get out, the prosecutor had a heart attack.
Yeah.
And so it was very Arthur Miller, very ironic, very kind of punch in the gut.
It's very good. It's very hard to choose what is the best. Of course, now that I'm met Antoine, he's the best story in the book.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's very hard to choose what is the best story because they're all out. You know what I mean? The story is, what was your knock on the door, Antoine?
My knock was Mr. Howard Joseph. My knock on the door was
when you first got pulled into the case.
Oh, when I got pulled in. Okay. I was going to say.
I want to talk about him, too, because he's something.
That's my hero.
Yeah.
What happened was we had just came back from New Orleans. We had played some music down in New Orleans. I came back, and I saw a card in my door, the detective's name. So right away, it makes me nervous. So I'm saying, wow, let me call this guy.
Yeah.
So I called him. And but prior to that, my neighbor said she'd seen all these police around my house. I couldn't figure why. Why they around my house?
Wasn't here.
Right.
Yeah.
So when I put everything in the house, and then I took the card and called. He said, we just want to talk to you about something that went on in the neighborhood, and we want to ask you a few questions. I said, ask a few questions about what? He didn't want to tell me. So then some of the neighbors told me what supposed to have happened. And so I called. And then I contacted a lawyer. Don't trust Chicago police, you know.
Sure.
Paid a lawyer a lot of money.
A lot of money. Went to the police station. Lawyer dropped me off and left.
Oh, man.
Took my money and left. And it's another story about this guy. Maybe we'll get a chance to tell it the next time we come. But this guy just took my money, he left, went to his daughter's birthday party. And that's when the injustice started.
Yeah.
So I sat in the room with a guy about 45 minutes to an hour, and this guy was actually the police witness against me. Me and this guy, I didn't know him, he didn't know me. And then the detective came in, took him one way, asked me would I stand in the lineup. I said I would. Took me another way. That guy identified me and said I was the one.
Oh, man.
He also was the same guy, long story short, that came back to court and told why he lied on me. You know?
Unbelievable. Tell me who this Howard Joseph is.
Howard Joseph.
This is one of the great heroes of the whole book.
Yeah, man. Howard Joseph, he came down. You know, he would remind you of Columbo, right?
Yeah.
He was about 70, about 72, 73 then. He came down and they said, man, you got a lawyer visit. I said, I don't have a lawyer. You got a lawyer visit. So I went to see. He told me, he said, hey, sit down. I'm your lawyer. I said, what's this old, you know, little Jewish white man, you know what I'm saying, that I just fell in love with because his heart is so true. He says, two things I'm going to tell you. Pay attention to your case. Nobody know it better than you, and I'm going to get you out of here.
Wow.
Stay patient. And he did.
How did he find you?
My sister and his son worked together. My sister was just telling him about what happened to him.
Yeah.
And his son said, hey, well, my dad, you know, who's a real estate attorney at this time, used to be a criminal attorney, he said, maybe you send me the paperwork and I give it to my dad. He took it to this old man who do not have a computer, who do not have electric typewriter, who do not have a secretary, who do not have a major office, office smaller than his studio, and said that I'm going to take this case and get him out. He did it all on his own.
Yeah, that's an amazing, amazing part of your chapter. That is an amazing part.
So we give out an award every year, too. Mm-hmm. It's called the Howard Joseph Award.
I don't blame you. He's no longer with us, is he?
He with me every day.
That's a good
every
way
to, day.
A good
and
way
I have that. His degree. His son, his family
yeah,
gave
know.
Me his.
Yeah, that's in this
his,
chapter, too.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, I'm spoiled now, man. I don't know what to do.
Well, it's a good story. Laura Caldwell, how many innocent people are there in jail?
Well, the guesstimate is that 5%. And, you know, that would mean that 95% of the time we're getting it right.
Yeah.
So 95% of the time when someone pleads guilty or is found guilty and goes to prison, you know, 95%, that would make me feel good if that was accurate. And so I hope it is. But that would still mean that there are about 110,000 people in prison.
That's a chilling. That is just a chilling statistic.
I wonder where they got those numbers from.
You think it's more?
I think it's more.
When you were in jail, you must have...
A matter of fact, half the guys that's out now are in prison with me. Sean Wuerl, who just came home and got married, was in prison, always said, and I'm innocent. You know, I know so many guys, you know, and those guys are coming home today, you know.
Having served their sentences?
Having served the sentences. And this one guy actually just got out. Locked up 34 years for a crime, and they won't even let him do the DNA on the stuff to prove his innocence, even though he's done the time. You know, and it's a shame that our system is set up like that. I just don't understand it.
Well, Laura, you're fighting. I mean, you're not fighting the system. You're an advocate for... I don't want to make this all sound so adversarial because that's not who you are.
She's an advocate for the system, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
She is.
I agree.
I think I have high hopes for Kim Fox and her administration. She seems devoted to criminal conviction integrity units, which Barry Scheck has spoken with her about and various other people, and from the Innocence Movement have reached out to her and explained, you know, we need to not only have an integrity unit that where we're double checking has to involve people not in the office. Otherwise, it's tricky. But, you know, she's been listening to these things.
Put an exoneree on the panel.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I would pick you.
It's not a bad idea.
I would
definitely go.
Because yeah,
if you committed the crime, I think you should do the time. I'm not into people getting off scot-free.
Of course.
I'm the wrong, you know, it's the justice behind it.
No. Can this be, so the entire system can be, mistakes are made.
Mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, this is not a widget factory where every once in a while, even widget factories, the mold gets wonky and like 2% of their product doesn't work. So, you know, it's human actions that are being judged by human people, then by other humans down the road. It's
human error.
I stand by my assertion that we have at its core the best criminal justice system in the world in terms of what's written into our Constitution about due process and being tried fairly and arrested fairly. And frankly, you know, I did a book trip to Malaysia. I had this big crowd and I thought that people were just loving my translation in Bahasa. In my sort of romantic comedy novels, turns out that in Malaysia, you can get picked up and never charged and never returned, and every person has had someone in their family.
Yeah,
so
there are horror stories
at least
over this
we don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope this book goes a long way to, it certainly should open people's eyes, no question about that. Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies from the Wrongly Convicted. It is also because you have so many good writers here, it is it's like the antithesis of an academic book. It's just a fabulous, quick read. I mean, that was obviously your intention, right?
Yes, and then the proceeds go to Life After Innocence. So we'll be able to continue.
Antoine, I'd like to write about you for the paper, along with Laura. I think I'll do that. I want to talk about your career now. You still play music.
Still playing music, and I'm also promoting different friends and different things and throughout the city. You know, I'm working with the kids at BBF Family Services and working with the community.
Well, who is this Adele Givens?
Adele Givens is one of my best friends, her and her husband, Tony. We're promoting this show at the DuSable Museum for the 13th of May.
Next Saturday.
Saturday from 7 p.m. to 10 a.m. All should come out at 740 East 56th Place, Chicago, Illinois, at the DuSable Museum. Everybody know where that is, right?
Yeah,
they have
a
beautiful auditorium there.
They really do.
We're
going to
have
a
great time.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to pack the house to show them that there's so much talent in Chicago. It's just a gift. It's terrible to just let it go to waste. And
you were talking off air, and Laura Caldwell and I were like, yeah, that's a good idea to maybe put on shows, which would be a gun give bang. You know, you don't need $60 to get in. Bring us a firearm, and you'll get in.
So we're going to have those concerts to come up where we can also they bring a gun turn. It's going to be a gun turn in. We're going to promote safety around the city of Chicago. If we can get one gun off the street, we'd have done 1,000, days of good work because there's so many here that we can get rid of them, but it's going to take the city to come together, and this got to be a collaborative effort from everybody, all parts of the city.
Yeah, you have a great philosophy. You have a great philosophy.
It's all about giving back.
Yeah, I know, but at one point you were screwed.
Right, I was.
But you still come out of that whole situation with this give back attitude.
Yeah.
And another, we're all in this together. I know you were in this, Laura Caldwell.
Quite triumphant, this one.
And we should keep writing novels, but as long as you keep writing books and editing books as good as and do such a great job of smoothing over the prose of Arthur Miller, Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongly Convicted is a fantastic read. It's 15 different stories, black, white, male, female, not all different ages, but a pretty big age range. And it's a modern day, I think it's a modern day horror story, and it's a modern day story of hope and triumph, too. How's that?
That's going on the back of the paperback.
Antoine, you like that?
I like it. I love it.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's my pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Always.
And I will be in touch. And again, Antoine would like you to know that Adele Givens will be at the DuSable Museum of African American History, 740 East 56th Street, next Saturday from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Can I give you guys a shameless plug? When I found that my case was overturned, it was in the Tribune.
Really?
In the newspaper. We didn't even know. My attorney didn't know, and I didn't know. And we was reading the Tribune in the penitentiary and found and saw it.
Wow.
My case was overturned.
Shout out to the good. Tribune.
Okay, all of you people should subscribe to the Tribune. If you
to
have
the
any,
Trib.
If you have any friends in prison, you should subscribe to the
right.
Tribune.
Send it to them.
Antoine, it's a pleasure to meet you.
My
Laura,
pleasure.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is really a stunning, stunning piece of work. You can go to anatomyofinnocence.com too and find out more about it, or just go to Laura, just Google Laura Caldwell. Thank you both.
Thank you both.
I'll be in touch. We're going to take a little commercial break, and then I will play you a song, and then I will go home. Chicago native Karen Mason is coming back to Chicago May 17th to 20th at Davenport's, and that's davenportspianobar.com, or KarenMason.com. She is out with her first CD in 9 years. It's called It's About Time, and here is one extended cut from it. You'll know what this song is.
The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend. The world and all its capers, and how it all will end. Nothing seems to be lasting, but that isn't our affair. We've got something permanent. I mean, in the way we care. It's very clear. Our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and today. The radio and the telephone, just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay, but our love is here to stay. And the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going along.
She's a great singer, Karen Mason. She's a local lass who went on to huge Broadway fame. Once more, she will be at Davenport's May 17th to the 20th. I'm going to play her accompanist. He has a new CD out, too. I'll play him next Sunday. Thanks a million for listening. I'm sure you could sense what a more finely produced show this is than normal, because Lise Graham has been hired full-time to be the producer here. You heard her at the top of the hour. She has her own podcast, and pretty soon she'll have her own show. So thanks, Lise. It's great to have you on board. Aubrey Mumpower really steers this ship.